This is The Guardian.
Rishi Sunak stood on the steps of 10 Downing Street when he became Prime Minister and promised the country a new, stable, sane kind of government.
This government will have integrity, professionalism, and accountability at every level.
That now feels like something from 500 years ago. In just the first 3 days of this week, we've had Lee Anderson's defection to Reform UK, and The Guardian has broken the story of a Tory donor, his £10 million contribution to party funds, and his horrific views about Diane Abbott.
The comments were wrong, they were racist. He has rightly apologised for them, and that remorse should be accepted.
Isn't it good to know that the great Tory ship of state is sailing smoothly onwards? I'm John Harris, and you're listening to Politics Weekly UK for The Guardian. Joining me today are The Guardian columnist Gabby Hinsliff and our political correspondent Kieran Stacey. Hello to you both.
Hello, John.
Hey, John.
Hi. Before we get into party politics, as usual, it might be an idea to talk about the one thing everybody's been speaking about this week, that royal photograph, more specifically that manipulated, photoshopped royal photograph and the great frenzy of reaction that manipulation and photoshopping has caused. I'm a Republican. I've said that before on this podcast. Doesn't mean I don't take an interest in these things. I suppose what I'm struck by is twofold. A, I feel very sorry. I kind of always have, really, for most of the people, not all of them. Most of the people at the heart of the institution of the monarchy having to cope with that level of sort of speculation and prurience and all that. And this isn't a bad example. It also struck me, really, that in all the coverage of that photograph, and everything around it, that after the Queen's death, the monarchy suddenly looks very small and very fragile and accident prone. It's sort of diminished. Now she's not here. Gabby, you're nodding.
Yeah, I do feel that. I mean, everybody is talking about it, and it is one of those stories that's kind of escaped into the wild. You know, people are actually talking about it on the school run or talking about it in normal life, in the pub, wherever. But I kind of wish we all weren't in many ways. There's a large part of me just thinks she's very clearly not well. She's had major surgery. She's been out of circulation since Christmas. She's got three young kids. I feel sorry for the Princess of Wales that she felt obliged to put a photograph out there to shut everyone up. And I do feel it's kind of back off and leave her alone time, really.
But it's in the nature of the institution that we can't, or we're told we mustn't back off and leave them alone. That's not what it's there for.
I mean, we totally can. We totally can choose to do so.
A lot of newspapers for commercial reasons don't feel they can back off.
But
as we know.
And the job is being out there. But it makes me feel uncomfortable.
I feel bad asking you this, Kieran, because if this is political, it's political with a very small p. Have you taken any interest in this at all?
Well, I've had to, really, because it's all everyone wants to talk about. And I get home, you know, full of Westminster gossip and nobody cares. Everybody just wants to talk about this particular photo. It's one of those things where, I mean, A, it's a useful reminder for those of us caught up in Westminster politics that our obsessions are not necessarily what the country is obsessed by. B, it's been a little bit worrying for me just to see how many relatively sane friends I have who've gone down very deep rabbit holes on what has happened with that photograph and are kind of, you know, several layers in on Instagram or Twitter, trying to do a bit of amateur detective work. And you think, okay, on this one, it probably doesn't matter so much. I mean, obviously there are real people involved, but you then start to think forward to a general election campaign. If people are kind of this susceptible to conspiracy theories, what's it going to be like when there's actually high stakes going on?
Yeah. Speaking of someone who did go down a few of those rabbit holes, the one involving the cover of Vogue, I've been quite deep down. Have you been down that one?
This is the side of you I don't normally get to see.
Yes, everyone has Vogue,
the Vogue reading side of you. I'm not saying it's not what we normally see in the studio.
It's a bit about photo manipulation, but it's a very deep rabbit hole. Let's not go down that. I just had a sort of idle moment. Let's move on to other matters. Let's talk about the Conservative Party, their very high-rolling donor, Frank Hester, and The Guardian's exclusive news story. Obviously, two big stories have dominated the news this week. That's one of them. They're both related to the Conservative Party and this arguably failing, or, you know, incontestably failing government. We will talk about Lee Anderson's defection to Reform UK in a moment. But firstly, let's talk about that story in The Guardian. Excellent reporting. The story of Tory donor Frank Hester making some absolutely dreadful comments about Diane Abbott. They've been dominating the news this week. The Guardian revealed details that this millionaire CEO of a software company told colleagues that looking at Diane Abbott, quote, makes you hate all black women, unquote. He also said that the MP, quote, should be shot, unquote. The comments were made in 2019 when he was apparently criticising a woman employee of another company. A statement from his company said that Hester, quote, accepts that he was rude about Diane Abbott in a private meeting several years ago, but his criticism had nothing to do with her gender nor colour of skin, unquote. Let's talk about the response on the part of the government to the stories about that quote and about Frank Hester. It's been pretty abysmal. Let's be honest about that. First of all, I mean, you know, it's sort of evolved in this very awkward way over the course of 8 or 9 hours. Let's hear, first of all, what Mel Stride, the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, said when he was speaking to Sky News on Monday.
Well, it's clear that what he said was inappropriate. He has, as I understand it, apologised for those remarks. I think the critical point here is I don't think what he was saying was a gender-based or a race-based comment, but it was clearly inappropriate. He has apologised, and I think we need to move on from that.
It took a full day of cabinet ministers refusing to call the comments racist before Number 10 was finally forced into a U-turn. And Rishi Sunak said the comments allegedly made by Frank Hester were racist and wrong. Kieran, why did it take so long? And what do you think eventually pushed him into taking a different line?
The answer to the second of those questions is slightly easier to answer, I think. What pushed him seems to have been the response by Kemi Badenoch, the business secretary, who came out and was the first cabinet minister to go out there and say, this is racist. And I think the clarity of her tone and her message on that pushed Number 10 into taking the same tack. I suspect the reason they didn't want to go there in the first place is because this is a lot of money at stake. There is, we know, of £10 million that has been given to the party. That is not nothing, and they are desperate to keep hold of that. They probably can't right now afford to pay it back. And I think that Downing Street's been very conscious that the further they go down the line of criticising what Hester said, the closer they are to having to give the money back. And that's the position they really don't want to get to.
I think there's also, I mean, a degree, I'm going to agree with all of that, but I think there's also a sort of wider concern about donors generally. If you were considering giving money to the Conservative Party, and let's face it, there can't be an awful lot of people now thinking, yes, I want to throw £10 million at a Conservative election campaign that's kind of destined to lose. So your donors might be fairly thin on the ground anyway. But the idea that if you give money to the Conservative Party, it's kind of open season on things that you've said, things that you've done in the past, that you can become a scandal that can embarrass you and drag your company into it. Whenever a donor gets into trouble for something, you know, any political party wants to move the conversation on as quickly as possible so it doesn't scare off other people who might be willing to donate to the party. And you don't want to be seen to hang someone out to dry. All of that said, I just think they're going to end up giving the 10 million back. They're going to have to end up giving the money back, or at least saying they'll never take any money from him again or whatever it is.
And just quickly, Kieran, you're nodding. So you think also that the money will sooner or later have to be given back?
I just don't see how it ends in any other way. I think that, you know, you now have a growing number of people, including on the Conservative side, who are calling this out, calling the comments out as, you know, as racist and being willing to condemn them. You now have an increasing number of people saying that they should hand the money back. So we've just had, just after PMQs, in fact, the Scottish Conservatives condemned the comments and said they shouldn't. They would never take money from him. So the more that happened, by the way, just as Number 10 officials were briefing the press, as they do every week after Prime Minister's questions. So those comments broke in the middle of that press briefing. But the more that you have of comments like that, the longer the story is going to carry on.
If you're any good at politics, the fact that that is precisely how it's going to play out should be uppermost in your mind as soon as the story breaks, right? So you take a line, you come out with it quickly, and for better or worse, you stick to it. That seems to me to be an iron rule, particularly when you're in power, of how politics ought to work. And Rishi Sunak's crap at that. Because let's not forget, this isn't the first time this plotline has happened. This follows much the same plotline as Lee Anderson, apart from the fact that they ended up not saying Lee Anderson was
and a number of other a number of other decisions, going all the way back to, you know, the beginning of the pandemic, when Rishi Sunak took a long time to accept that furlough might be necessary. You know, he is one of those people, as we learned last week, someone who takes the time to go back and make an unmade bed and restack an inappropriately stacked dishwasher in the middle of their working day, apparently. Well, that's what he told Grazia. Is someone who likes to dot all their I's and cross all their T's. And in times like this, when it's a scandal is breaking and you've really got to react quickly, because the more, if you take, you know, if you drag it out, all that happens is it's more painful. You come to the same decision eventually, but after 3 days of disastrous publicity that you didn't want, he's still not very good at leaping to that point of going, look, we're going to have to do this in the end, so let's do it now.
Do you think in this case, and also in the Lee Anderson case, there is a reluctance to use words like racism and Islamophobia because there might be some sort of political or electoral blowback that they don't like?
I think there are two things going on. I think one is there's a reluctance to use those words. They'll say that it's rude or it's wrong or it's something or it's they're bad, but I can't possibly tell you why it's bad, and not use the sort of R word because there's a squeamishness about using that, and maybe a squeamishness about labelling Tory voters who might agree with some of those things or not see what's wrong with some of those things, about labelling them as racist. But I think there's also generationally, perhaps within the Conservative Party, there's a sort of split between older conservatives who think that saying a racist thing is like, say, you know, is a really obvious example of racial discrimination, or saying something like people should go back where they came from, that's obviously racist. And they kind of don't get that the slightly more subtle variations of racism are also racism, whereas younger Tories, you know.
So that's right, Kieran. There's something in reading across from this into what happened with Downing Street's reaction to what Lee Anderson said, and see this sort of common theme and this sort of squeamishness about calling things out for what they are. That's definitely there.
There's ways in which they are similar, and that's about the decision-making processes and the inability to see round corners and kind of see where this is going to go. So get to that point straight away.
Yeah, but on this point about not liking words like racism and Islamophobia.
Well, I think on the two issues, they were quite different, and partially because, as you were saying with Lee Anderson, his comments were, let's be honest, they were much more subtle than Frank Hester's. There were quite a few Tory MPs who did actually back Lee Anderson and continued to back him and continued to say, like, well, we should bring him back. He apologised. Yeah, it wasn't that bad. Almost nobody is saying that about Frank Hester now, that it's, you know, what he said wasn't that bad. And I think in a way, the fact that Kemi Badenoch came out and was so clear as, you know, the highest profile black MP that the Tory party has, that kind of then gave Rishi Sunak cover to do the same thing. But I do think there is a difference between the two sets of comments. I wonder, and, you know, I hope this isn't going too far, but I wonder whether there is, to a certain degree, a squeamishness on the part of our first Prime Minister of colour to actually come out and say these kinds of things. And I'm saying this as a kind of second generation Indian immigrant myself. I know that you have to be very careful of someone in that position about calling other people out as racist. It's an easy thing to do, and it can be very, very inflammatory if you get it wrong, and people can get very angry about it. I suspect, and I've got no particular evidence about this, but I suspect there is just an element of that going on in Rishi Sunak's mind.
Diane Abbott has said that she feels less safe. I mean, Diane Abbott must feel unsafe a lot, if not all the time, because as we all know, the levels of abuse and violent threats and worse that she gets are off the scales, so to speak. Anyway, in response to the Guardian story, she made a statement saying, "It is frightening. I live in Hackney. I don't drive. So I find myself at weekends popping on a bus or even walking places more than most MPs. For all of my career as an MP, I have thought it important not to live in a bubble, but to mix and mingle with ordinary people. The fact that two MPs have been murdered in recent years makes talk like this all the more alarming." Because we've talked so far about what the government had to say about whether these comments were racist. But the other thing is that he said or talked about Diane Abbott being shot, right? And we all know the context for that. Gabby, you're nodding. And that is as big. I mean, if, you know, one shouldn't draw equivalences or say one thing's worse than the other, but that makes this even more abhorrent, right?
I think that
hardens the case immeasurably for the money going back. After David MS was killed, after Joe Cox was killed, you cannot have political donors, therefore, they're players in politics, right? It's not like they're just people who hand the money over and walk away. Once you've made a donation, certainly of that magnitude, you're in it. You're a political animal, right? And to say something as outrageous as that, when we all know the context for it, is beyond the pale.
You know, it's only a couple of weeks since Rishi Sunak was making a big noise about MP security and threats to MP safe, personal safety, and, you know, heightened fears in the wake of the current climate. And we know we're going to come on and talk about it in a minute, but we obviously know we've got this government announcement on extremism coming up. So you can't simultaneously be saying that, you know, a parliament is under threat from these kind of sort of thuggish, undemocratic forces kind of ranged against it, and at the same time bend over backwards to someone, say that someone who said that an MP should should be shot, that's absolutely fine. We'll take their money. You know, it's not just an embarrassing question for the party as a party now. It's an embarrassing question for the government. It starts to spill over into their policy positions. It's just a mess from start to finish, really.
Kieran, there was a sort of outbreak of unease at PMQs on Wednesday over the fact that Diane Abbott tried to ask a question and didn't get called by the Speaker.
Yeah, it was definitely an issue. It was kind of, as the session went on, it became the main issue that people were muttering about behind their hands. And, you know, I suspect MPs, but definitely those of us up in the press gallery as well. So the tradition is, for those who don't know, that anybody who hasn't got their name down on the written order paper to ask a question, they will go into the chamber and they'll stand up in between each question to make it known to the Speaker that they want to ask a question, even though their name's not down. And usually the Speaker finds space for one or two, maybe a few more MPs from either side who've not been listed to be able to do so. Now, we went through the entire of PMQs. We had Keir Starmer talk about Diane Abbott. We obviously had Rishi Sunak talk about Diane Abbott. We had Stephen Flynn talk about Diane Abbott. We had Marcia de Cordova, another Labour MP, talk about Diane Abbott. We didn't hear Diane Abbott talk for herself. I've just, in fact, as we're speaking, received a response from the Speaker's office saying, you know, there was a limited time. The Speaker had to prioritise members who were already listed on the order paper. I mean, if there is ever a moment to break convention, I think this was it. To have an entire chamber of House of Commons talking about one of their own members and not to hear from that member themselves was completely extraordinary, looked absolutely awful, and it's not the first time, as we've discussed before, John, that the Speaker's got himself into a right tangle.
Yeah, that's the point. We know perhaps why he got this wrong was that he broke convention not that long ago and landed himself in trouble, and so he hasn't got the agility now to do what's required in a situation like this.
That's exactly how it feels. And to be honest, and we discussed this, I remember, on the night of that SNP debate, I think that there was a defence that the Speaker could have said at the time, which was, every so often, on extraordinary occasions, you have to break convention. Arguably, that was one of them. Almost certainly today was one of them. And he obviously didn't feel that he could do so.
Now, while we've been having this conversation, Diane Abbott has retweeted an article on the Speaker not calling her at Prime Minister's questions, saying, and this is a quote, "I don't know whose interest the Speaker thinks he is serving, but it's not the interest of the Commons or democracy." Here's a question. Diane Abbott, as we know, currently sits as an independent MP. You know, in quite a sad way, she's a sort of lonely presence in the House of Commons, which I think is some element of how people have reacted to this story. Does anyone think that Keir Starmer's got a bit of a brass neck, staunchly defending Diane Abbott and sort of celebrating her contribution to politics, which she did on TV, on the Lorraine programme, I believe, despite her not having sat with other Labour MPs for over a year?
I think it would have been a lot worse if he hadn't defended her, to be honest. This goes beyond party lines. It doesn't matter if she is or isn't ultimately readmitted to the Labour Party after the current investigation into anti-Semitism is over. You know, I think anybody from any party ought to be able to defend Diane Abbott. I wonder if it was one of the reasons that Kemi Badenoch came out so much more strongly on this than the Prime Minister did, is that she's talked about how the number of threats against her have escalated in recent times, you know, due to various things, that the criticisms that were made of her internally within the party. I think all MPs who have had some kind of security threat made against them, which is an awful lot of them now, feel kinship with Diane Abbott over this.
Let's talk about this other week's Conservative drama so far anyway. You know, there may be more to come. That played out on Monday when the very vocal, vociferous, high-profile MP for Ashfield and former Tory Deputy Chair Lee Anderson announced that he was defecting to Reform UK. Kel Surprise, as they say in Reform UK. The party headed by Richard Tice and linked to Nigel Farage, who I think at the moment is its honorary president. This is what Lee Anderson said.
"We are giving away our way of life. We are allowing people to erase our history. We are giving up our streets to a minority of people who literally hate our way of life. We are allowing people into our country that will never integrate and adopt our British values. Parliament doesn't seem to understand what many British people want. And quite frankly, some of them need to get out more."
Just by way of a reminder, Lee Anderson lost the Conservative whip last month after he refused to apologise for saying the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, had, quote, "given our capital city away to his mates," unquote. Let's just talk a bit about Lee Anderson and his politics and who he is. How much of this is about ego, do you think, Kieran? He just wants to be on the telly.
He wants to be on the telly. He wants to be invited to all the champagne parties. He wants to be a member of the private members' clubs. You know, all of this obviously plays to a certain extent. He's quite a complicated character. You know, he used to be a Labour councillor. He then defected to the Tories. He's now defected again. He says because his parents told him that they wouldn't vote for him if he stood as a Tory.
He's 57 and he's still talking about what his mum and dad say he ought to do.
It was a very strange press conference when Reform unveiled him as a candidate. I mean, he stood up there and was incredibly tetchy in what should have been presumably his moment of glory as Reform's first sitting MP. But he was incredibly tetchy about taking questions from political journalists. And I think that kind of gave you an insight into his mindset. You know, he doesn't like the political elite here in Westminster, the establishment, and that probably includes both major parties.
And yet he wants to stay here, though. That's the thing. I mean, there's that thing about, oh, I hate the Westminster elite so much I want to remain a part of them, except just for my third party.
And also likes a good Westminster in-joke. You know, he was referring to journalists by name and using in-jokes about them and to them. So, you know, he's certainly part of the fabric over here.
Among several talking points about Lee Anderson is this one. He trades on the idea, it seems to me, that he's the authentic voice of the sort of post-industrial working class. You know, he gets a free pass to present himself that way. And I wonder whether you don't really get to grips with, now it's Reform UK, Lee Anderson-type politics until someone in mainstream politics has enough sort of gusto and confidence to say that that's not right. You know, Lee Anderson doesn't speak for nearly the number of people he thinks he does. And therefore, he doesn't carry that weight. Do you see where I'm coming from saying that?
Yeah, I do. And I think, I mean, he always poses as, you know, I'm the true voice of the people, you know, I'm the true voice of Ashfield. And I think we'll find out at the next election whether that's actually the case. He won the seat pretty, it was a marginal seat. He won it narrowly. I don't know that he wouldn't have been expecting to hold it at the next election.
Labour might well take it back. But he's got more of a chance of holding it, has he?
No, I don't know, because he'd have to win it for Reform. And I think at the moment you've got, you know, in that seat, I went to Ashfield in 2019 and it was an ugly campaign then, because it was, you know, he defected from Labour not that long ago, a couple of years before that. So it was very bitter. It was very tense. He wasn't just a Labour councillor. He was the MP Gloria De Piero's office manager. So he took with him, you know, all the secrets and all the inside knowledge, went over to the Tories and then ran against his old boss, you know, essentially in that election. And then she'd stood down by 2019. There was another candidate. It was all very bitter. The day I arrived, they were sweeping up because somebody put a brick through the window of the constituency office. You know, it was a nasty campaign, nasty, personal and aggressive. And 2024, you suspect, is going to be that with stilts on. Lee Anderson has become synonymous of something much broader in politics, which is a tendency to assume kind of the worst almost of Red Wall voters, to treat Red Wall voters as if they're some kind of weird alien species who've got like kind of views trapped in the 1950s and blah, 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 blah. It's a very crude reading of what a whole swathe of people stand for.
No,
and
I think politics and political commentary very often thinks that people who vote for people like Nigel Farage are exactly like Nigel Farage themselves, right? In every conceivable way, you know. There is this great block of people who like UKIP, the Brexit Party, Reform, whatever it's called, or voted for Brexit. And we assume that they're all of a type. And then that gives Lee Anderson, as he sees it, the authority then to stride around as if he's someone important. And no one will burst that bubble. Just before we have a pause, it'd be good to step back here and perhaps see this for what it is. You know, Reform UK has decided to really launch itself into the public consciousness by standing behind an MP who lost the Tory whip for saying something racist and refusing to apologise, right? That's what's happened here. I don't think that's sort of acknowledged enough, right? That Lee Anderson and what he said about Sadiq Khan is now built into Reform UK's brand, right? If you think that, if you have those kind of thoughts, we're the party for you.
But that was already Reform's brand.
It was, but
let's
very,
be honest.
Very,
I mean,
very,
it's
very
not
explicit now, and obviously, you know, I think that's toxic. I think it's awful.
I suspect they're not going to put off many of their voters with that, I have to say.
In a way, I think the opposite from you. In a way, I think that someone like Lee Anderson has ended up probably where someone like Lee Anderson should have been all along, which is in a fringe party rather than a mainstream one.
I'll make you one more prediction, John, and that's that this situation won't last. I don't think that Lee Anderson can remain the flag bearer for Reform while Nigel Farage is still on the scene. Farage hates other people sharing the limelight with him. He, under when it was UKIP, he used to get rid of anybody whose profile almost got onto the same level as his. And I suspect that there will be a clash between those two men before too long, and Farage will inevitably win that.
Let's pause here for a minute. When we come back, we'll be looking at the government's controversial extremism review and what it might be.
Thank you. In Norway, a woman's boyfriend forgets who she is overnight. In Detroit, a man is arrested, but he was never at the crime scene. In Spain, disturbing pictures of young girls have appeared, and no one knows who's behind them. Something strange is happening. A collision between people and artificial intelligence. Discover more in The Guardian's new series, Black Box. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes Monday and Thursdays.
Welcome back. The Community Secretary, Michael Gove, is expected to make a speech on Thursday to provide an updated definition of extremism, in quote marks, if you prefer them. This comes off the back of controversy about pro-Palestine marches across the country and in London in particular, and Rishi Sunak's speech, remember that, outside Downing Street a couple of weeks ago. Michael Gove wrote a piece in the Sunday Telegraph where he confirmed that the government will publish a list of organisations that they consider to be extremist.
So there's two elements of what he's going to say on Thursday. The first element is, what is the new definition of extremism going to be and how are they going to police that? All of that is kind of relatively settled now. The second element is he going to call out specific groups as extremist? Now, from what I've told, the government has actually decided not to publish a list of groups. They think that that will be subject to legal challenge and could end up kind of completely distracting from what they're trying to do. But I'm also told that Michael Gove himself wants to name some of those organisations he believes are extremist and wants to do so in the chamber of the House of Commons, where, of course, he would be legally privileged to do so. So I suspect that at some point, whether it's Thursday or afterwards, we will see Michael Gove stand up and name some of these organisations that he believes are extremist, which are not covered by the current definition of extremism.
Gavin, this sounds like a classic case of what Michael Gove arguably is, which is a political columnist trying to be a politician, right? So it's all about show and pushing boundaries and look what I've said this week. It's not about sort of practical government and what these proposals might actually count for seriously.
There was a practical case for redefining extremism in the face of a changing threat. There's kind of what we used to think of as political extremism. You might have thought about neo-Nazi philosophies, or you might have thought about Islamic fundamentalism or whatever. You wouldn't have predicted 5 years ago that, you know, there would be extremist violent threats linked to 15-minute cities and traffic calming measures. Extremism, the nature of extremism has changed, and you want to make sure you're capturing all of that in a definition. Fine.
You can't.
I think there's a problem, however. There's two problems. One is that if you make it broad enough to capture all the different kinds of it, it becomes incredibly vague and starts catching all sorts of people that you didn't want to catch. But the main problem here is, if you do it in the run-up to an election where you appear to be trying to make political capital out of saying the opposition is in bed with extremists and they won't stand up to them and this government will, then inevitably whatever you produce is going to be politicised. And if he wants, one of the reasons you suspect that Michael Gove wants to stand up and read out a list of organisations that he considers beyond the pale, I mean, maybe he'll surprise us and put the Conservative Party on the list, or I think it's unlikely. So I think what you'll get is a list of organisations that have close links to Labour.
Oh, yeah,
and that'll be the point. You
so
know, the whole point,
panic pieces
the
about
whole
the
point
that, yeah, we know,
will
we
be
know
able to
script.
Say that, you know, and actually at that point, whatever purpose there is behind it becomes discredited and becomes used in quite a deep, tawdry and quite dangerous way, actually, given where we currently are in a very incendiary climate. And what you want is government to be pouring oil on troubled waters rather than kind of, you know, setting fire to everything it can see around
it.
I
mean, we've already seen that script being followed. You know, you find a Labour MP who shares a platform or is seen in the company of maybe someone from Just Stop Oil or Extinction Rebellion or whatever, and then the Daily Mail runs a piece saying that this is absolutely beyond the pale and how dare this person be knocking around with his people and this represents the end of democracy as we know it. And off you go. When, interestingly enough, actually, it's the conservative side of politics, as we've seen lately, which certainly in the case of individual figures seems to be blurring over into a sort of extremist, you know, fringe element of politics, which is prone to say incendiary, dangerous things. Do you know what I mean?
I think, to be fair, they are
in a glass house throwing stones here.
They are in a glass house throwing stones, and I'm sure the first question that Michael Gove will get at the first press conference is Frank Hester an extremist under your definition or not? You know, and I'm sure everyone's going to be trying to link the two. But I think the truth is that both political parties, at the fringes and the edges and the extremes of both political parties, both right and left, can veer off into conspiracy theorist territory, and therefore you take politics out of it as far as you can. You don't try and use it for your own political advantage.
Kieran, it is quite a Michael Gove intervention to make, isn't it? very sort of showy and politically flamboyant and provocative and all of those things.
Yes, it is. And he, look, I think in actually not a bad way, he is quite good at getting attention for what he does. He really is good at finding gaps in the news agenda and using them to highlight things he cares about. One thing I think I would disagree with you about, John, is I don't think this is pure party politics. I mean, for Michael Gove, this is something he has thought about and felt very strongly about for a long time.
But not in a very serious way, arguably. He published in a book called Fahrenheit 77. And do you know what I mean? He has got a history of sort of making showy, provocative, not entirely substantial kind of interventions.
I think he thinks it. I think that he really, really deeply feels that there is an existential threat to Western democracy posed, especially by Islamic groups. Now, whether you think that makes any sense or not, I think he genuinely believes it. This isn't just a way to embarrass the Labour Party. One thing I would say is that if he did want to embarrass the Labour Party, one way to do it, for example, would be to name the Palestine Solidarity Campaign as one of the groups that he believes are extremist. And there was some talk over the weekend that he was going to do that, which would make it very difficult for Labour because they've got lots of MPs who, you know, are supporters of the PSC and have gone out on marches with them. From what I've told, he's not going to do that now. I suspect he's had legal advice that doing so would actually be quite a bad idea. But I think also because he is quite serious. I think he means this. And I think he does want to focus attention on the groups he genuinely believes are a threat rather than just make it all a Conservative Labour fight.
Let me raise another question. I wonder whether this view of extremism and radicalisation is very old-fashioned. You know, the idea that there are extremist and radical groups with a codified set of beliefs that you can go and find somewhere and then judge to what extent they threaten liberal democracy as we know it in these various ways. Now, a lot of political extremism, certainly political violence, doesn't seem to work like that anymore. Our colleague Raphael Baer has written a column this week in The Guardian in which he says, and I think this is a really interesting point of view, naming beliefs that can't be reconciled with democracy is tricky when lots of opinions have a moderate version and a fanatical extrapolation that can justify atrocity. Jo Cox was killed because she was campaigning for Britain to remain in the EU. Her murderer saw himself as a soldier in a liberation struggle against foreign powers that conspired to swamp white Britain with migrants. It wasn't like he was a member of an organisation with a constitution that says ABC that's clearly identifiable, right? It doesn't work like that. And in that sense, I wonder whether Michael Gove's energy might be better expended going to speak to the people in charge of tech companies whose algorithms, very often it seems, guide people from mainstream politics out into the very violent, extremist, radicalising fringes. You know, that's how a lot of this works now. It's not a world in which someone's a member of something called the League of Something, which is pledged to this belief.
It's not like the 1970s anymore. But I think what the bit, if we'll be interested to see what the strategy, you know, contains when it comes out. But if what they're after is intervening at an earlier stage, trying to get to that point, because, you know, and Raph says exactly the same thing, you know, that there's a point where somebody's view, which you might or might not agree with, kind of tips over the edge and becomes violent or becomes so extreme, becomes so zealous that people who don't agree with you become a legitimate target, or you start to feel that it's okay, it's legitimate for you to deploy violence, or it's legitimate for you to deploy extreme intimidation in the pursuit of your goal. And it's if you're trying to identify the point at which someone tips over from just holding a belief into that kind of, is radicalized to that point of acting on it, then, you know, I think most people would be supportive of that and would think that's a legitimate aim to identify that bit where someone's tipping over the edge. But I think you have to question whether this close to an election with no time left for legislation, with very little time to do anything except for kind of make statements and get headlines for them, if that's really what government is doing here.
Thank you for joining us, Gabby and Kieran.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, make sure you subscribe to Politics Weekly UK wherever you get your podcasts, and even better, leave us a review. The latest episode of The Guardian's new podcast series, Black Box, is also out now. This Thursday's episode looks at how AI is going to transform our lives in ways that will be extraordinarily positive, it says here. For example, imagine if there was a machine that could see cancer years before a human being can. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Kagoutier, and the executive producers are Maz Ebtahaj and Nicole Jackson.
This is The Guardian.